Read and Understand, Book 4, by Betty Kirkpatrick and Rebecca Mock. Published by Learners Publishing. This CD contains the reading passages found in the book.
One. A grim discovery. A report in the local newspaper of the discovery of an unidentified corpse. The town of Springford woke to some shocking news yesterday. Police revealed that the body of a young woman had been found in a wooded area just outside the town. The person who made the grim discovery was 46-year-old Jim Bradley, who was walking his dog at the time. He told our reporter earlier today, "The dog's very well trained, and usually he stays close to me. But on Thursday morning, he went off like the clappers into the undergrowth. I could hear him, but I couldn't see him. I wasn't best pleased because I had intended staying on the path and wasn't wearing the right footwear for tramping through the undergrowth. When I eventually reached the dog, I couldn't believe my eyes. He was scrabbling away at something buried in the ground, and there was a human arm sticking out. I thought I was seeing things. I moved forward to take a closer look and saw that the dog was in the process of uncovering a dead body. I put the dog's leash on him and pulled him away before calling the police on my mobile. I wanted to get out of there right away, but the police asked me to stay where I was until they arrived. I wasn't at all happy about staying there, I can tell you, but I had no choice but to sweat it out until the police arrived. The dog had the wind up as well and was whimpering and shivering at my feet. Fortunately, the police were quick off the mark and they were with me very quickly. My heart goes out to the relatives of the poor young woman, but I just want to try and put the whole thing to the back of my mind, although I doubt if that will be possible. I'm sure that I'll be having nightmares about this for the rest of my life." Meanwhile, Detective Inspector Tony Miles said that there was very little that he could tell us at this stage. "It's early days in the investigation, but we will be pulling out all the stops to find out who did this terrible thing to the young woman. As yet, we cannot reveal her identity, as her next of kin have not yet been informed. We will keep you informed of developments as they arise. Meanwhile, we would ask the public to try and stay calm."
Two. A sales report. Information sent by a sales director to his staff. The end of the financial year is approaching, and with it, the AGM, when we will have to give an account of the year's proceedings to our shareholders. As usual at this time of the year, I'm sending a copy of this informal end-of-the-year report to all members of the sales force. I hope that you will all find it useful, and that you will let me know if you have any comments. I value your input. We started this year with a major new product, and we really hit the ground running. Our sales for the first quarter of the year were very impressive, and indeed broke all records. This was particularly heartening, as this occurred at a time when many of our competitors were feeling the pinch. Indeed, there was talk among economic experts of an impending recession, and even of economic meltdown. Fortunately, this gloom and doom did not materialise. It was good that we were able to buck the trend, but as I said, we had a major new product, and one indeed that is popularly believed to have broken the mould of kitchen equipment. Therefore, it would have been extremely surprising, not to say distressing, if we had not achieved substantial sales with it. What is rather distressing is that the rest of the year did not live up to the promise of the first quarter. This despite the fact that the financial state of the country improved in the course of the year. To some extent, of course, it would not have been realistic to expect that peak level sales could be sustained throughout the year. Some falling off was to be expected after the initial impact of the new product had worn off. However, the falling off was worse than had been anticipated. This gave us all food for thought, and fortunately, we were able to learn from the experience. Indeed, I think we should regard the introduction of the new product as a useful learning curve from which all departments have benefited. The whole program of product launching has been assessed and revised where appropriate. We shall all be better prepared next time. On the whole, this was a successful year, and we hope to build on that success in the coming year. Thank you all for your contribution to this success. Get ready to do even better next year. Three. Problems at work. A letter giving news of office politics and events. Dear Sam, I hope you're enjoying the course. You certainly chose a good time to be away from the office. I thought I'd better write and put you in the picture about what's been going on here in your absence. Forewarned is forearmed, and you might decide not to bother coming back. Most of us are seriously thinking about leaving if things don't improve. It all started when Mr. Brown was taken ill suddenly. Apparently, he was at death's door for a while, and everyone was very worried about him. However, the doctors eventually found out what was wrong. He's had an operation and he'll be up and about next week, although he won't be back in harness for a couple of months. And that's the problem. Unfortunately for us in the office, Mr. Brown's sister was visiting him from America when he was taken ill. She's now, as she puts it, at the helm while he's off work and has installed herself in his office. When we first heard about it, most of us weren't much bothered about it, although having someone brought in over him made the deputy manager hopping mad. However, we had a swift change of attitude when we met Mrs. Wiley, as she's called. She's 50 if she's a day, and is definitely a case of mutton dressed as lamb. She must spend hours putting on her slap in the morning. Not that we care what age she is or what she looks like, but we care about how she treats us, and that is very badly. She has her own business in New York, and she's always telling us how much better her staff are than us. I bet they're having a ball while she's away and hoping that she won't come back. It's impossible to please her, and she criticises everyone's work all the time. Mr. Brown's secretary simply could not stand it any longer, and is now off ill with stress. The rest of us are thinking of joining her. When she arrived in the office, her opening gambit was that we must all work very hard to ensure that the business did not suffer while the owner was away. It's suffering, all right. No one likes her, and we're losing both clients and suppliers. See what I mean about staying away? Best wishes, Billy.
Health scares. A commentary on the issue of health scares. It seems that hardly a week goes by without the publication of a new health scare. If we were to take all these scares seriously, we would be afraid to eat anything at all. Yet, it is difficult for the layperson to decide which should be taken seriously and which should be taken with a pinch of salt. All of them seem so convincing when we read them, and most of us do not have the specialized knowledge to separate the wheat from the chaff. Should we be protected from such scares until they are at least completely scientifically substantiated? Is it once again the media, always a convenient whipping boy for everything, it seems, who are to blame? Not so long ago, we would have been kept in the dark about health scares, as we were about so many things. But this is the age of communication and of communication technology. Shouldn't the media take the wraps off things that we should be concerned about? The communication revolution has meant that we all have a great deal more information to absorb than was the case formerly. This is a time-consuming exercise, and it is often difficult to get one's head round some of the more complex information. To make matters worse, much of the information is ever-changing. This is particularly true of the food field. It seems that no sooner do we take on board what we should eat and what we should not, than they move the goalposts. Many of us thought we had got the whole thing sussed. We should avoid red meat like the plague, because it increased our cholesterol levels and was bad for our hearts. Then it was chicken, which was a no-go area, because of the risk of salmonella. Still, at least fruit and vegetables were all right, positively bursting with goodness, we were told. Not so now, apparently. Recently, we have been advised that a considerable amount of fruit and vegetables which are on display in our supermarkets have unacceptably and even dangerously high levels of pesticide in them. It appears that whenever we open our mouths and put something in it, we could be damaging our health. We just cannot avoid living dangerously if we are to eat. Probably, the only thing to do is to stop worrying about it. Worry, after all, also endangers health. Five. Desperate immigrants. An exposition of the situation of asylum seekers. There is growing concern about the number of immigrants who are seeking asylum. Then, there is the question of their safety. Many of them are so desperate to leave their own countries and start a new life in another that they will grasp at any opportunity which they believe will enable them to do this. Sadly, many of them risk life and limb and still do not fulfill their dream. Unscrupulous people are taking advantage of asylum seekers by promising to get them into the country of their choice by fair means or foul, provided they give them money. The desperate asylum seekers are parting with money which they have scrimped and saved for all their lives, and are even taking the money which aging parents had set aside for a rainy day, and giving it to these people. They have high hopes of a safer, better life, and the money seems well worth it. Most of them do not have the ghost of a chance of being granted asylum in the country in which they wish to settle, especially if they try to enter it illegally, but they are often ignorant of this fact. There are some who do know the score, but are prepared to take the risk anyhow, particularly if their lives are in danger in their own countries or if they face imprisonment by staying there. A great many asylum seekers who try to leave their countries with the help of profiteers are putting their lives in the hands of these charlatans. Various dangerous methods are attempted to get asylum seekers into their preferred destination, and many asylum seekers are injured or even killed in the process. Some are hidden in container lorries for long periods of time with not enough food and drink and not enough air to breathe properly. Some have even been found hanging on for dear life's sake to the bottom of trains. Always, they are under threat of discovery as well as danger. Even those who, against all the odds, do succeed in reaching their promised land, often face disappointment and heartache. Frequently, they find they are not allowed to stay in what they regard as a safe haven. They end up by being deported, frequently spending several uncomfortable and frustrating months before finding this out. The dream which was within their grasp has been snatched from them.
Six. Miraculous Rescue. A report of a near-fatal fire in a local newspaper. A city fire nearly ended in terrible tragedy for a city family last night. A woman and her three young children were asleep upstairs in their home at 5 Woodview Terrace when a fire broke out in the kitchen and spread like wildfire. According to firefighters, the family would all have perished had it not been for the quick action of their next-door neighbour, 53-year-old Martin Giles, who climbed up a ladder to rescue the children and their mother, 36-year-old Margaret Redwood. One of the children, 5-year-old Becky, was suffering from severe smoke inhalation and had to be taken to hospital. At first, there were fears for her safety, but doctors have declared that she's now out of the woods and will be able to leave hospital tomorrow. Miraculously, the other two children escaped without a scratch. Mrs. Redwood sustained minor burns and is still in a state of shock. The children and their mother owe their lives to Mr. Giles, who threw caution to the winds and risked his life to save the family. "I didn't stop to think. I was on automatic pilot. I just saw the flames, heard the children scream, and raced to get my ladder. Anyone else would have done the same. I got them out just in the nick of time. The whole house went up like a light, just as Mrs. Redwood got out." Mrs. Giles called the fire brigade as soon as they saw the flames. But despite responding instantly to the call, the firefighters arrived too late. The house was a blazing inferno when they arrived, and there was little they could do. Said fireman Jack Lauder, "Usually, we advise members of the public to leave rescue work to the professional, but those children would have died if it had not been for Mr. Giles. He is being too modest. He really laid his own life on the line to save the kids. For us, that kind of rescue goes with the territory, and we're trained and equipped for it. It's all in a day's work. But Martin Giles is a real hero. He deserves a medal." The cause of the fire appears to have been faulty electric wiring. Said fire investigator Paul Jennings, "From what I can see, the wiring was in a terrible state. The whole house was a death trap. It's amazing that no lives were lost."
Seven. Flood damage. A report in a local evening newspaper about the effect of flooding on the city theatre. Staff arriving for work this morning at the Carousel Theatre discovered that they were up to their knees in water. The water supply to the building was immediately cut off and the drying out operation began. There was no heavy rain in the city last night, and, indeed, it is one of life's little ironies that this whole area has recently been experiencing drought conditions, and people have been asked to conserve water supplies. The most likely explanation is that flooding was caused by a burst pipe. However, it has been rumoured that a member of staff accidentally left a tap running in the theatre bar after a party at the theatre. The owner of the theatre, Mr. Mark Burchill, who has been on holiday in France, has said that he is devastated by the damage to the building, and that if any members of staff are found to have caused the flooding through negligence, then heads will roll. Meanwhile, he says that he is more interested in getting on with clearing up the mess than with discussing the whys and wherefores of what happened. The flooding is a double whammy for Burchill, since his flat is next door to the theatre and has also suffered a great deal of damage. The extent of the damage has not yet been assessed, but the theatre manager, Bill Redpath, speaking on behalf of Mark Burchill, said today, "I would like to say that it would be business as usual, but there is no possibility of this. The theatre, along with the bar and restaurant, is going to have to close down completely for extensive repairs. We have no idea how long repairs will take. At this stage, it is a case of how long is a piece of string. We hope that work will begin almost immediately and will progress by leaps and bounds." There has been speculation that Burchill will see the flood damage as the last straw and will close down the theatre. It is known that he has been struggling financially to keep the theatre open, and that there have been rumours for some time that closure was imminent. However, Burchill has issued a categorical denial that he is considering the closure of the theatre, and has said that such a thing would happen over his dead body. Be that as it may, many people in the area regard the flooding as a blessing in disguise. Said one of them, "The property is in a shocking state of repair and should either be pulled down or completely renovated."
Eight. Closure of a local bookshop. A report in a local newspaper. Book lovers will be sad to hear that the owners of Morton's, the well-known High Street bookshop, have announced its closure. The family-owned bookshop has been selling its wares in the town for more than 50 years, and it will be sorely missed. Mr. Robert Morton said last night, "We're having to close because of financial circumstances. It's Hobson's choice. We have fought tooth and nail to keep the shop open, but our efforts have been unsuccessful. Now we've decided that enough is enough. Bankruptcy's been staring us in the face for some months, and we wanted to act before we had to call in the receiver. It goes against the grain to accept defeat, but we must acknowledge that we have reached the end of the road. This is by no means the first time that we have been in a tight corner, but on previous occasions we were able to see some light at the end of the tunnel, and managed to cope until things improved financially. This is not the case today. The future holds little hope of improvement. A few years ago, we would have had no difficulty selling either the business or the building. Now, after many months, we have given up trying to find an owner for the business. And the building is still on the market. There is simply no demand for commercial property in the centre of town. I'm afraid that this will be the shape of things to come for the town. People prefer to shop at the shopping complexes out of town, where there is plenty of parking space and where they get a large selection of goods in a relatively small area. At the same time, the cost of maintaining property in the town centre is going up and up. Town centre shops are facing a very uncertain future, and I fear that several of them will soon be in the same position as we are today. Jim Park, a representative of the local Chamber of Commerce, agrees wholeheartedly with what Robert Morton said. "This is a sad day for the town," he commented, "and it could well be the thin end of the wedge. With parking facilities in the centre of the town becoming more and more limited, more and more people are choosing to go out of town to do their shopping. Sadly, it appears that high street shopping is in danger of becoming past its sell-by date, and something must be done quickly to ensure that there is not a general exodus of shop owners from the high street. It would be extremely bad for the town to be left with whole rows of empty shops on its main street."
Nine. Bills, bills, bills. An account of financial and other family problems. Lucy looked through the letters which the postman had just delivered and said to Mike, "Nothing but bills again. What are we going to do? We can't possibly pay them all this month." "We'll discuss them tonight," said Mike. "I'm late for work." Where bills were concerned, Mike was apt to bury his head in the sand. Meanwhile, Lucy sat at the breakfast table, having another cup of coffee, and remembering the halcyon days when she could go out and buy new clothes and makeup without thinking twice. It had been yonks since she had bought anything for herself. All the money seemed to go on household bills or the twins. Lucy loved the twins dearly, as did Mike. But their arrival had undeniably knocked Lucy's plans for six. Her pregnancy had been planned and she had been looking forward to being a mother, but she had also planned to return to work, at least on a part-time basis, after the baby was a few months old. She enjoyed working, and they would need her salary even more when the baby was born. However, it was very much a case of the best-laid schemes. A few months into her pregnancy, Lucy was told by the doctor that she was expecting twins, and when the two bundles of joy arrived, it was obvious that Lucy was going to have to postpone her plans to go back to work. Finding childcare for one baby was hard enough. Finding childcare for two babies of exactly the same age proved impossible. Lucy's mother had been prepared to look after one baby part-time, but she drew the line at looking after two. She was apologetic, but felt that she was too old and did not have enough energy to care for twins. Then there was Mike's mother, but she had a part-time job, and she and Lucy did not really get on. At one point, they had had a major row, and although they had agreed to let bygones be bygones, things were never the same again. Lucy and Mike's mother would never see eye to eye on childcare, and in any case, Mike's mother did not offer to help with the twins. As if things were not bad enough, Mike seemed to have forgotten about his assurances during Lucy's pregnancy that he would share the task of looking after the babies. He said that it was just not possible to share and share alike when he had to go to work and Lucy did not. His only contribution to childcare was to give his sons and heirs a cuddle when he came home from work.
Ten. Footballers required. An appeal from the PE department to the students of a school. Students are warned that we will almost certainly have to reduce the number of school teams from 4 to 3, or even 2, if more people do not turn up for training on Wednesdays after school and on Saturday mornings. We are extremely reluctant to do this and are appealing for your help. Ideally, you should have at least some football talent, or at least not have two left feet. First and foremost, however, you should have commitment. Our problem at the moment is that several potential members of the football teams seem to think that they can simply turn up for practice when they please, or when they have nothing better to do. This is not the right attitude. You cannot pick and choose which practice sessions you will attend and which you will not. You have to attend them all, come rain or shine, if you are going to be good enough to play for any of the school teams. Furthermore, while you are at the practice session, you should be prepared to give it your all. We need keen players who are willing to train hard in order to be fighting fit and in top form. For your health's sake, you should consider taking more physical exercise rather than be content to become a couch potato. There have been many medical reports recently which have stressed the importance of young people getting more exercise. Football is an excellent and enjoyable way of doing so. The thoughts of some of you are already focused on post-school education and training, and rightly so. A word in your ear. It is often not enough to have good academic results in order to impress people with your CV. Extracurricular activities are also of great importance. You should bear in mind that many universities prefer to have students who have some prowess in some form of sport, not least because they wish to gain success on the sports field as well as in the exam room. Not only that, but many business firms give preference to those who can prove themselves to be team players. What better proof than actually to have been in a team? Our first team is going from strength to strength at the moment. Indeed, it is head and shoulders above any other in the school league. The second team is also playing well and has achieved a number of successes. But we need committed players for the other two teams, which we regard as our training teams. Come and join us. You may discover that you have hidden talents.
Eleven. A surprise job move. A conversation on someone's reasons for changing jobs. "I've just heard that Mike's moved jobs," said Jack to Peter. "The strange thing is that he's moved to a much smaller firm and he's usually so ambitious. It doesn't sound like the kind of thing he'd do. Moving to a larger firm would be much more his style." Peter replied, "I was talking to him briefly last night, but he didn't have time to give me any details. He said he'd tell me all about it next time we meet. I gather that he still liked the work he was doing, but the marketing department where he worked had become a revolving door. A lot of people left before Mike did, and their replacements are staying no time at all. That must be very unsettling for everyone." Just then, Mike walked in, and they asked him what had happened to make him change jobs. He began to tell them the background to his move. "To put it in a nutshell, it's all the fault of the new marketing director. About 6 months ago, management decided that as a company, we didn't have a high enough profile, and they got rid of Jeff Jones, who was head of marketing, and appointed someone to improve the image of the company. Unfortunately, the new broom is one of those people who takes an instant dislike to some people and sets out to make their lives a misery. I don't know what he's done for the public image of the firm, but morale has hit rock bottom. It's particularly sad because Jeff Jones was a good boss, and it was a very happy department when he was there." Peter said, "That's dreadful. It's very difficult to work under such circumstances. How did you get on with him? I got on with him all right, I suppose. But his mood could change from one minute to another. None of us knew where we stood with him. I decided early on to get out while the going was good, and was lucky enough to get a job with Smith & Jones. They're a much smaller company, but you can see that they're going places. They treat their staff well, and so they stay around. It might be, in the end, a good career move then, said Jack. Perhaps he did you a favour after all. Certainly, said Jack. I've taken a cut in salary at the moment, but looking at the big picture, I can see that my promotion prospects are much better. You wouldn't go back to your old job if this new man left then? Asked Pete. After the way management let him treat us? Asked Mike. You must be joking.
Twelve. Launch of a lunch club. A speech launching a lunch club for senior citizens. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to preside over the proceedings at the first meeting of the Woodville Lunch Club for Senior Citizens. We all hope that this will be a great success and that there will be many more to come. I'm extremely pleased that so many of you are able to be here today, and I extend a warm welcome to you all. I would like to say a particularly warm welcome to Mrs. Joan Miller, who is 94 years young today. I'm sure that you will all join me in wishing Joan a very happy birthday. The aim of the club is, of course, not only to provide food, although it is extremely important that people of all ages eat nourishing food, and I can tell you now that it is absolutely delicious. I've already sampled it. However, the club exists to provide companionship as well as food, and I'm sure that many of you would like to stay on after the lunch things have been cleared away so that you can have a chat. You may well find a kindred spirit among the other club members. Companionship is important when you're getting on a bit and feeling a bit lonely, and it's not always easy to find. I'm no spring chicken myself, and I know that I don't make friends as easily as I did when I was younger. There just aren't the same opportunities available when you are not as young as you were, and so you should all make the most of this one. Of course, many of you have the companionship of family, and families are all very well, but if yours are anything like mine, they'll always be in a hurry. They rush here and there doing this and that at a rate of knots and making us old ones feel that we're in the way. Most of them don't mean to make us feel like that, of course, and they'd be horrified if they thought we did. But it's all too easy for us to feel that we're beyond our shelf life in the midst of all this frenzied activity. Somehow, life didn't seem quite so hectic when I was young. Today, we're not in a hurry. We're providing an oasis of calm so that you can get to know each other. Although I'm sure that by the time you all get chatting, it won't be an oasis of calm anymore. It'll probably be more like the Tower of Babel. Indeed, I hope that will be the case, because that will show that you're all enjoying yourselves. And that's one of the main points of this club. Have fun!
13. The Young's View of the Old. A conversation giving contrasting views on the elderly. "What are you laughing at?" Jane asked Meg, as they met while walking their dogs in the park. "I was just telling my grandson that I was thinking of taking up salsa dancing, and he was horrified. He said I was much too old to do anything so energetic, and that I might fall and hurt myself," replied Meg. "He obviously thinks that I'm over the hill." "My granddaughter's the same," said Jane. "She's always giving me little hints about what I should and shouldn't do. They hate us doing anything that'll draw attention to ourselves and embarrass them. I'm having fun dancing at a party at their house last week, and she looked at me as though she would like to tell me to act my age. I told her that you are only as old as you feel, and she wasn't a bit pleased. Mind you, she treats her mother, my daughter, in the same way, and Sheila's only 45. "Yes, they clearly think that anybody over 25 shouldn't have any fun at all," replied Pike. "And they obviously regard us as absolutely ancient. They probably think that we grandmothers should spend all our time sitting in rocking chairs by the fireside, knitting." "That'll be the day," said Jane. "Apart from anything else, I can't knit for toffee. Tell me more about the salsa dancing. That sounds much more my cup of tea. I should take more exercise anyway." "Oh, I wasn't really serious about that," said Meg. "I've a much younger friend who goes every week to a salsa class, but I'm not really tempted by the idea. I much prefer yoga. I was really only winding my grandson up when I mentioned salsa. I knew exactly how he would react. And he reacted true to form. He's so predictable. You'd think that they'd be glad that we're leading independent lives and not hanging around them all the time, asking them to do things for us and generally getting in their hair," said Jane. "Yet they seem much more concerned with what we're doing than we are with what they're doing. I don't remember worrying about what my grandmother was doing when I was that age. Do you?" "No, but that's probably because she was sitting by the fireside, knitting all the time, or doing all the housework," laughed Meg. "Times have changed, and now golden oldies like us can do anything we like, as long as we are in good health and can afford it. The world is our oyster. But don't tell my grandson I said so. He'll buy me a rocking chair." No food in the flat. A conversation on responsibility and doing one's share. "There's absolutely nothing to eat in this flat," said Tony, looking in the fridge. "The weekly shopping should have been done last night. Whose turn was it?" "Do you really have to ask?" said Ronnie wearily, not bothering to look at the roster, which was pinned to the kitchen wall. It was Jeff's, of course, but he forgot, as usual. "He really doesn't pull his weight around here. I'm sure that you're all as tired as I am of dancing attendance on him. He never does a hand's turn. Someone should tell him that he'll have to go if he doesn't start doing his share. That might jolt him into doing some of the work." "Rather you than me," said Andy. "He'll go ballistic if you even suggest that he should go. Besides, you're forgetting one important thing. It was Jeff's flat originally, and his name's on the lease. We all moved in after him, if you remember. If we start making waves, he might well tell us to go. Perhaps we'll just have to put up with it. Anyway, we could have worse flatmates than Jeff. He may have an appalling attitude to housework and shopping, but he's very easy to get along with, and he can be a lot of fun," Tony said. "The trouble with Jeff is that he was brought up with four older sisters who waited on him hand and foot, and he was the apple of his mother's eye because she had waited so long to have a son. He's used to having everything done for him. It's not really his fault, although I must admit that it's annoying. Nice work if you can get it, said Ronnie, but he's not at home now. Just seems to live on another planet most of the time. When he does remember to buy food, he buys incredibly expensive gourmet items and spends the entire week's food money in one fell swoop. He never buys things like common or garden cheese or tins of baked beans. That's true, said Andy. Perhaps it's just as well that he hardly ever does the shopping. Otherwise, we'd all starve. In fact, I'm starving right now. All this talk of food has whetted my appetite. There's no point in standing around here complaining about Jeff and his faults. You know as well as I do that the leopard doesn't change its spots. I'd rather spend the time doing the shopping myself. Then we can eat. Well said, agreed Tony. I'll come with you if you like, and we can stop off at the pub on the way back. Don't you dare, exclaimed Ronnie. I need some food as soon as possible.
Fifteen. Brainstorming Session. An introduction by a marketing director. You are all well aware that this is not the time of year for our sales conference. I have called you together for an extra meeting, and one which has a very specific purpose: the exchange of ideas. Of course, we always aim to cover this at the annual conference, but there are so many things to be dealt with there that there's never enough time to allow for an adequate ideas session. Many of you must leave the conference hall thinking that you did not have an opportunity to get a word in edgeways, and that's a great pity. I hope to remedy this today because this meeting consists of a series of brainstorming sessions. We hope that you will all make a contribution. The sales force is no place for shrinking violets, and so let's hear from you. I'm sure that you all usually have plenty to say at the conference coffee breaks or in the pub afterwards, and so now is your chance to communicate your thoughts to a wide audience. It's all too easy in a large organisation for management not to involve the rank and file to a great enough degree. Undoubtedly, the management team will have regular councils of war among themselves, at which they will consider a whole raft of measures and proposals for making the company more aggressive and more profitable. It's likely, too, that the management team may have focus groups among their customers, who will advise them on what the customer is looking for in a particular product. Such groups have been found to be invaluable to us in our efforts to understand the mindset of potential customers. However, the people who do the actual selling of the product, and indeed the people who make the products, are often left out in the cold. They rarely get a chance to put in their penneth, and this is unfair. As the marketing director, I'm not in a position to do anything about the producers of our product, but I am providing those who sell our products with an opportunity to have their views heard. I want you all to speak straight from the shoulder. There is no point in organising these sessions if everyone's going to pussyfoot around, afraid to say what they really think in front of management. We want to hear what you have to say, whether this takes the form of a complaint about the way things are run, a suggestion about improving efficiency, a proposal for increasing sales, a plan for a new product, or whatever. Right, everyone, get talking. Sixteen. A summons from the managing director. A conversation on the reasons for the summons. The managing director would like to see you in his office, said Brian to Lucy and Johnny. He didn't say what it was about, but you'd better go right away. You know he has a short fuse if people keep him waiting. Are you sure you don't know what he wants? Asked Lucy suspiciously. Lucy didn't like Brian very much, especially since he teased her a lot. Scout's honour, replied Brian. But perhaps someone's told him that you two are an item and he wants to complain. One of you might have to leave and get another job. Don't be ridiculous, snapped Lucy. We're both in the advertising department. And he probably wants to talk about this season's brochures. In any case, there's no rule that says that members of staff can't go out with each other. Why should he care? I was only joking, replied Brian. Don't get your knickers in a twist, and you should be making tracks. Don't just stand there, Mr. Giles might think that I forgot to tell you. You shouldn't let Brian rattle your cage, said Johnny to Lucy. He just teases you because you rise to the bait. If you ignore him, he'll stop doing it. Now, let's go and see what old Giles wants before he comes looking for us. Lucy and Johnny were with Mr. Giles for a long time, and their colleagues were beginning to wonder why. Usually, visits to the managing director were extremely brief. They've been gone a long time, said Mary. You don't think old Giles is on the warpath because they're going out with each other? No, I don't, said Anna. In all conscience, there's no reason why two members of staff shouldn't have a relationship, as long as it doesn't interfere with their work. Mr. Giles has no grounds for complaint. Just then, Johnny and Lucy appeared, looking far from happy. Their colleagues were anxious to know what had happened. Did you get it in the neck from old Giles? Asked Brian. No, we didn't, said Lucy to Brian. He's very pleased with our work. In fact, he complimented us both on our report writing. Unfortunately, that means that he's chosen us to help him compile the new company mission statement for next month's shareholders' meeting. Worse, he wants it by this evening, and I have a lot on my plate already. I don't suppose anyone feels like helping. Absolutely not, said everyone. Brian went off laughing, much to the annoyance of Lucy. Seventeen.
New competition. A managing director tells his workforce of a threat to their business. As you are probably aware, one of our major American competitors, Steiner & Warbuck, is planning to open a branch of their company in our area. Obviously, we do not yet know how this will impact on our business, but we must try to ensure that it will have as little effect as possible. The bottom line is that we are the market leaders in this area, and we must strive to maintain that position. I'm not even going to pretend that this will be easy. Steiner & Warbuck is a much larger company than ours, with considerably more financial resources. We will certainly not, from our point of view, be competing on a level playing field. However, we do have some advantages. We have been established for some time in the market, have a good reputation, and have a good many extremely loyal customers. In recent years, we have regularly improved on our sales figures and have increased the profitability of the company substantially. Also, we have the advantage of time. The news of Steiner & Warbuck's plan has just been announced. When they what act to the property, which they have just for 3 months. Since the building in need of extensive innovation and refurbishment, will be some considerable time before they move in and get the branch up and running. Then there will be the problem of staff. I gather from a reliable source that they plan to send a senior management team over from the States until the business here is on stream. However, they will have to establish an infrastructure from local resources, and that could prove quite difficult. We all know that there is a lack of trained administrative staff available locally. All this, then, is to our advantage. But we must certainly not rest on our laurels. We must react positively to the arrival of our competitors. With this in mind, we are organizing an aggressive marketing campaign starting next month. All our effort must go into this, and so please put this first when you are prioritizing your workload. You will all be given weekly targets, and although they may seem very high and even unattainable, they reflect the kind of effort that has to be made if the firm is to survive the arrival of this competition. As yet, I have no other information about our competitors' plans. But when I do, you may be sure that I will keep you up to speed. We must not be caught napping. There is work to be done, and I must not keep you from it any longer.
CV deception. A conversation on a staff member's CV deception. I have a piece of bad news for you, said Meg to her boss. You're going to have to start looking for an office manager again. What? Exclaimed Mr. Ramsay. But Sally just started 2 days ago. She can't have resigned yet, surely. We're not as bad a firm as that. No, she hasn't, replied Meg. But you're going to have to give her the boot. At least that's the message from head office. She's to leave the building right away. Oh no! It took me such a long time to go through all the applicants and select her, he said, sitting down at his desk and putting his head in his hands wearily. What's she done? Surely she hasn't had her hand in the till already. It's nothing like that, replied Meg. Apparently, she airbrushed her CV, and the HR manager at head office has just found out. Basically, she invented a degree and a business diploma. Her references were genuine, although they gilded the lily a bit, but they were written by two close friends of hers. They run a business together, and she used to do some part-time work for them occasionally, but not work of the standard required here. Actually, it's just as well it was discovered now. She would never have coped with the work. Words fail me, cried Mr. Ramsay. I thought I was a good judge of character, and she seemed the best of the bunch. I must be losing my grip as an interviewer. You can't win 'em all, said Meg comfortingly. You're usually spot on when it comes to choosing people for jobs. Don't blame yourself. It's apparently quite common now for people to tell lies in their CV, and many of them are never found out. Sally was unlucky, I suppose. They don't always check educational qualifications, it seems. But the deputy office manager, Mary Brown, did a business diploma at the same college as Sally claimed she had been at, and graduated the same year Sally said that she did. It was a small college, and Mary didn't know her. Mary could just be making a mistake, I suppose, said Mr. Ramsay. I'm afraid not, Meg replied. They checked with both the college and the university. Sally had never been registered at either, and so the HR department started checking the rest of her CV, found out about her references, and the rest is history. I need a cup of coffee fast, said Mr. Ramsay. I can't believe I'm going to have to start the interviewing process over again.
Jim in trouble. A conversation on how to deal with the situation. Someone, who shall remain nameless, must have told Mum that I was home a bit late last night, said Jim. She's absolutely furious with me. Don't look at me, replied his sister Mary. I don't know why you think someone had to tell Mum. It was quite obvious that you were late home. You made such a noise that you woke the whole household. And you weren't just a bit late, you were extremely late. I looked at the clock, and it was the wee small hours when I heard you stumbling upstairs. You were supposed to be home by 11. Nonsense, exclaimed Jim. It may have been a few minutes past the witching hour, but that's all. I remember looking at the clock in Joe's house as I was leaving the party. Then your eyesight must be getting very bad, or you got badly lost on the way home, was Mary's reply. Joe only lives 2 streets away. Do you think Mum might have forgotten all about it by this evening? Asked Jim, hopefully. Perhaps she'll have calmed down. She doesn't usually stay angry with us for very long, does she? Get a reality check, said Mary. You know she has a bee in her bonnet about us being in at a reasonable time during the week. She thinks staying out late will affect our college work, and she's so keen for us to get good qualifications. But I don't have any lectures this morning. I don't have to be in college until this afternoon. I could have still been in the land of Nod if Mum hadn't come barging in and woken me up at some ungodly hour to tear a strip off me. She was still breathing fire when she left for work. She was so furious with you that she didn't even say goodbye to the rest of us, replied Mary. What time will she be home? Asked Jim. Is she working late tonight? Ask me another, said Mary. Why do you want to know? Well, I thought that if I could get her calmed down, she might let me borrow the car, replied Jim. I'm going over to Jenny's flat this evening, and it's right at the other side of town. The bus service to that part of town is terrible. Don't push your luck, advised Mary. The best thing that you can do is keep out of Mum's way for as long as possible, preferably by staying in your room and studying. She probably won't allow you to leave the house tonight, let alone lend you the car. I think you're underestimating just how angry she is. Controversial toll charging. A radio interview with a local councillor.
Councillor Brown, thank you for sparing the time to come along and talk to us today. As you are aware, a great many people are concerned about the announcements of the council's decision to charge tolls on cars entering the city centre.
No decision of the kind has been made. The public concern can be blamed on the press, who are having a field day with this subject. Consequently, the whole situation has got out of hand and rumours are rife. The truth of the matter is that we are aware that something must be done urgently about the ever-worsening traffic congestion, and we are investigating a number of options. Toll charging is just one of these.
You're preaching to the converted here when you say that something must be done to improve the traffic situation. But is the charging of tolls a viable possibility? Owners of shops in the city centre are expressing concern that such a scheme would virtually mark the end of city centre shopping. Others fear that collecting tolls would simply add to the congestion while motorists queue to pay the tolls.
If there's one thing which I have learned in my long years of service as a councillor, it is that you can't please all of the people all of the time. Although everybody seemingly agrees that something must be done about the traffic, every time we put forward a proposal, someone throws a spanner in the works. Most motorists pay lip service to the idea that we need to reduce the amount of traffic coming into the city centre. But they want to look after number one. They don't want to use public transport.
But there's the rub. If there were better public transport, it wouldn't be an inconvenience to use it, and people would be more inclined to leave their cars at home.
It's a chicken and egg situation. We need more money in order to improve our public transport system to the extent that motorists will use it. It's only right, in our view, that some of that money should come directly from the motorists, although, I repeat, no decision has been made on road tolls.
I think that a great many people feel that it is more than time that the council did come to a decision about traffic. You appear to have been going round in circles for several years on the subject. We feel that you are not really getting to grips with the nuts and bolts of the situation.
That remark is most unfair and not at all helpful.